I'm Jen Psaki. Welcome to Diplopod. We're working on a lot of good things at Diplopod, including a new name, a new look, and lots of new episodes with the same foreign policy analysis you love. We'll be on hiatus for the next week while we work hard on these projects. And while we're out, we wanted to put some of our favorite episodes back in your feed. This week, I'm bringing back a conversation about how sanctions work. I talked with my colleague Jarrett Blanc in September of 2018 about how sanctions are often misunderstood and slapped onto foreign policy decisions as an afterthought. This is the first episode in a three-part series on sanctions, so definitely scroll back up in your feed to listen to the rest. We'll be back with a new episode and a new name next week. Jarrett, thanks for joining me in the Diplopod studio. So you're my co-pilot for the week for our 101 series on sanctions.
I'm super excited by this.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
And over the next couple of days, we're going to talk with Jack Lew, former Treasury Secretary, former White House Chief of Staff, who has written quite a bit and thought quite a bit about sanctions.
It's a little bit intimidating to interview Jack Lew on almost anything, let alone sanctions.
That is true. And we're also going to talk with a lawyer who's an expert on sanctions.
So Greta is a sanctions lawyer. She knows these issues backwards and forwards, and I think that she's going to be able to give us a really good perspective on how lawyers here in town approach sanctions policy, and also how the private sector reacts when the U.S. puts a new policy in place. What kinds of questions do they ask? How do they change their business practice in order to comply with U.S. law?
So the way you and I have experienced sanctions over our time in government has been using them as a tool to get another government to do something, to change their behavior, to come to the negotiating table. So that's an important part of it. So let's talk a little bit about how that's worked successfully and maybe even unsuccessfully in the past, maybe with Iran.
So I think you're spot on that at least when we've thought about sanctions in the past, I think we've tried to approach them as a tool. How do we get a government to change its policies? Now, to be fair, I don't think that's the way everyone in the U.S. government thinks about sanctions. And they can be used sometimes just as a don't just stand there, do something tool.
As in the United States, we need to do something.
We need to do something. So let's sanction this entity, this country, without necessarily thinking through very carefully. Have we developed a tool that is likely to influence the target government in the way that we want? And so, as you said, we've had sanctions regimes that have worked and we've had sanctions regimes that haven't worked. And a part of that is just that, you know, some policies work some of the time and not all of the time. And a part of it is that we sometimes haven't really used sanctions, I think, in a way that is even intended to achieve a specific outcome with the target government. They really are just as a stand-in for some other more successful policy measure.
Yeah. And it seems like sanctions, I mean, they've used a lot more now in terms of a global tool. How have they changed? Can you talk a little bit about how the use of them has changed over time?
Sure. So there have been different periods of U.S. sanctions use. And so if you go back, let's say 30, 40 years, really all U.S. sanctions were about rules for U.S. persons, that can be individuals, companies, non-citizens who are living in the United States, what could they do with a foreign country or a foreign company? Basically, you know, you're not allowed to do business with Iran, or you're not allowed to do business with this Iranian company, or you can only sell humanitarian goods to Iran under these specific circumstances. Starting in the 1990s, people had a bigger idea, which was, okay, the U.S. economy is huge, and our sanctions, therefore, can really hurt a target company. But we're not the only economy in the world. The EU at this point has an economy about the same size as ours. China is, you know, almost the same size as ours at this point. Can we use our strength in the market to force foreign companies to stop doing business with our targets? And we introduced then this idea called secondary sanctions. So instead of just saying to the U.S., you can no longer do business with Iran, we said to, for example, European companies, if you choose to do business with Iran or with these targeted Iranian entities, you may not also do business with the United States.
And this has made the Europeans mad at certain points.
It's made the Europeans furious. It's an extension of U.S. law to non-U.S. entities. And so, and actually, ironically, the first real effort to do something like this didn't come from the United States. It came from the Arab League with the oil embargo on supporters of Israel back in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And it was the U.S. that then reacted angrily and said, no,
you can't do this to us.
Right. You can decide not to do business with Israel, but you can't tell us not to do business with Israel. Mm-hmm. But we changed that perspective starting in about the 1990s and imposed secondary sanctions on firms trying to do business with Cuba. Now, at the time, the Europeans were very united in their reaction to this and said, we're absolutely not going to accept it. It's also true that at the time...
Because in part, they thought that our policy toward Cuba was outdated.
Right. Exactly. It's not, you know, Cuba maybe means a little something to European economies, but not very much. In the same way that today, Iran means nothing to European economies. These are policy disputes, and Europe was saying, we don't want Washington and your sort of peculiar reliance on a set of voters in Miami to dictate our foreign and commercial policies. And so that, combined with the fact that the Clinton administration wasn't really on board with these congressionally mandated sanctions, led to a series of compromises whereby basically we have not imposed the secondary sanctions on European firms doing business with Cuba. And that was true under President Clinton. It was true under President George W. Bush, under President Obama, all the way through the lifting or the relative easing of sanctions under President Obama.
But we've done secondary sanctions with China, with as it relates to North Korea, in an effective way? Or what do you think about how we've done that?
So starting from that Cuba experience, we've expanded it ever so slightly as time has gone by. So one of the ways that we've expanded it was with Iran, where we said in a pretty broad way, if you do business, if you non-US person do business with these Iranian entities, you're not going to be allowed to do business with the United States as well. And that has actually, I think, that did work really well. And part of the reason that it worked really well was that we did it in a coordinated way with our European allies and partners. So the Europeans didn't love the policy angle that we were on. They certainly didn't love the reimposition of secondary sanctions. But because we were willing to cut deals with them and sort of compromise about what exactly are our targets here? What are our objectives? How are we going to seek to achieve them? The Europeans went along with us. And in fact, to overcome sort of this presumption against secondary sanctions, they imposed sanctions on many of the same targets so that we were all on the same page.
Because they shared the objective of preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, right? Which is sort of the difference from maybe the Cuba policy.
Exactly right. We were able to come to an agreement on the objective that we pushed them a little bit further, I think, in terms of the objective than they might have wanted to go. And maybe they reined us in a little bit from what we would have ideally chosen as our objective. But in the end, that left us with a coordinated policy where we were all able to work together. Now, you raised China and North Korea as well, and that's another really good example because, of course, unlike Europe, the Chinese are not deeply integrated into our financial system. And so when we threaten secondary sanctions, the Europeans may not like it, but they have to figure out a way to deal with that problem. Whereas the Chinese have a wider range of tools that they can use. They can cooperate with us. They can ignore us. They can create sort of channels that are really insulated from U.S. pressure and continue doing business in a way that it would be difficult for Europeans or Japanese or the Japanese or the South Koreans or other really closely aligned countries to do with us. Now, that said, we certainly have hurt a number of Chinese companies and banks by imposing our secondary sanctions, either as regards North Korea or Iran. And again, it's the Chinese can't just ignore us, but they do have a wider set of policy tools than some of our closest allies.
And just to stay on North Korea for a second, one of the criticisms of sanctions is the humanitarian impact, or that's talked about a fair amount, right? How will this impact the people of North Korea or the people of Iran? Because, you know, there's a fear that the governments will pass that impact on. So why is the humanitarian impact important, or how do you think about that piece?
So that's exactly right. And you know, if we go back to an earlier part of our conversation and you know, there are some sanctions that are just interdiction. They're really narrowly targeted. You're trying to prevent a certain person or company from getting a hold of certain technology. The sanctions we're talking about, which are these really, they're these strangulating sanctions that are trying to affect a whole economy in order to get a government to change course. I think we have to accept that they are going to have humanitarian effects, right? If you're going to hurt an economy, it's always the poorest people who are going to be hurt first. And, you know, that's a reality of foreign policy. Sometimes you have to make hard decisions. But I think that we should own up to it and be thoughtful and use the sanctions only at a time when we think that they might achieve the goal, because otherwise you're causing the humanitarian harm for nothing. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll also say that there are ways to minimize and to soften the blow. And I was disappointed last week when the International Court of Justice said to the United States regarding our Iran sanctions, while a certain case that Iran was brought was underway, we had to be careful to minimize the humanitarian effects, because if we lost the case in the end, if we hadn't minimized those effects on humanitarian trade, that would be an irredeemable harm. Mm-hmm. Right? The court couldn't find a way to fix that. And I think we could have had a great reaction there, which is to say, look, that's already baked into the way we do our sanctions policy, but we'll think carefully to make sure that we, even though we don't acknowledge your jurisdiction, we'll think carefully to make sure that this is really practical, that we're protecting humanitarian trade as far as is possible. But instead, of course, the Trump administration just pulled out of the relevant treaties in order to say, look, the Court of Justice has no say here.
Mm-hmm. Now, policymakers, we've talked a little bit about how much sanctions are used now, or how they're thrown out there in Washington as kind of the magic tool. We're going to talk to Jack Liu about how they should be used. But you've worked on sanctions a lot. How should they be used as a foreign policy tool in the modern environment we're in today?
So I think that there are a few useful lessons to keep in mind. The single most important one from my perspective is set your goals in a realistic way. So you can't use an economic tool to achieve changes that the target regime thinks threatens itself, mm-hmm. right? So if Iran believes that its ballistic missiles are necessary to preserve itself in a hostile region, then it's unlikely that any amount of economic pressure that the U.S. can mount is going to change that policy. You've got to choose targets that are actually amenable to economic pressure. Mm-hmm. And that means thinking very carefully about what does the target regime think about this question? What do they care most about? Similarly, I think you've got to think very hard about the political economy of the target country. So there's been a lot of really interesting work done recently about the political economy of Russia. And mm-hmm. if we target Putin's so-called oligarchs, are we doing something? Do they have any way of putting pressure on Putin and the regime?
Right, is there a connector? Is it going to make them change their behavior in some way?
Or even does it make them change their behavior the opposite direction? Uh-huh. Do these oligarchs then become so dependent on Putin that they're just reminded of how much they need the Kremlin? And then the last thing I would say is, again, we live in an interconnected world, and it is very hard to imagine achieving broad economic effects if we're acting alone. Right now, because of the strength of the U.S. financial system and the centrality of New York to almost every, even minimal transaction mm-hmm. that goes through euro or other global currencies, because of that, we have a huge amount of power. But we can lose that. The sanctions tool is very strong, but that doesn't mean that it's not fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are pushing our allies and partners to do things that they think are absolutely not in their national security interests, vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis Russia, mm-hmm. even vis-a-vis Cuba, I think we're going to see over not such a long period those allies and partners figuring out ways to work around us. And remember, again, the United States is a big economy, but there are other big economies out there.
And so we have a risk of it not being as effective.
We have a risk of losing the effectiveness of the tool. And one of the things that I really look forward to talking to Jack about is we have a risk of losing the centrality of New York in the financial system. Mm-hmm. What does that mean not only to our foreign policy, but to our economy?
Well, we'll be looking forward to that conversation. Jared, thank you for explaining to all of us Sanctions 101 and how to think about sanctions in this world we live in.
Thank you, Jim.
Diplopod is a production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Subscribe to Diplopod on popular podcast platforms such as iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at carnegieendowment.org/diplopod. Tim Martin is our audio engineer. Lauren Duick is our executive producer. I'm Jen Psaki. Thanks for listening.